Tuscaloosa Radio offers a new work in historical fiction, Stingaree Gulch, a ring-tailed, roaring good time.
Stingaree Gulch, a ring-tailed, roaring good time. The engine of the Thomas Flyer idled with a heavy, impatient rumble, spitting exhaust into the dry, goldfield air. Tex Rickard stood beside the automobile, flicking a freshly printed postcard against his thumb. Want a ring-tailed, roaring good time? Tex Rickard's Stingaree Gulch offers it all to sporting gentlemen. Honest gaming, 24 dance halls with their own orchestras, exotic pleasure houses with 600 girls on the line, all nations, all colors. Show this postcard at any establishment and Tex will buy you a drink. It was a bold promise for tomorrow, mostly to help him outrun the deadly mistakes of yesterday. By all rights, after staging the legendary Gans-Nelson fight, Tex should have been the richest man west of the Mississippi. But there was the little matter of Johnny Mays and his Philadelphia group. They had paid in advance for Joe Gans to hit the canvas in the 16th round. Instead, the fight dragged into a brutal 42-round bloodbath, the last 24 of which Gans fought with a broken left hand. Historians were already calling it the greatest middleweight bout ever fought. Johnny Mays, however, didn't give a damn about history. He cared about his money. When Mays cornered Blohm, Tex's ever-present giant German enforcer, and delivered a blunt, "make it right or else" ultimatum, Tex hadn't needed to think twice. A dead gambler spends no money. Within 48 hours, Tex dumped his massive, highly profitable northern saloon to Mays for a fraction of its true worth. "Bags are loaded, boss," Blohm grunted, tossing the last leather grip into the back of the flyer. Tex pulled out his gold pocket watch, checked the time, and nodded. To ensure Mays didn't send gunmen after them on the open road, Tex had arranged one final distraction. On his way out of town, he had a courier deliver Mays the deed to the finest brick house in Nevada, sold for a single silver dollar. It was a steal the mobster wouldn't be able to resist, and a cheap price to keep Tex's scalp attached to his head. "Put it in gear, Blohm," Tex said, climbing into the passenger seat. "We're going to Rawhide." Nat Goodwin had practically begged him to come. The vaudeville comedian turned theater tycoon had bragged of his $2 million fortune right before getting fleeced by master con man George Graham Rice. Rice had talked Goodwin into dropping nearly $200,000 on six Hooligan's Hill mining claims just outside Rawhide, using a bribed state engineer to fake the yields. Tex had no interest in swinging a pickaxe. Hard labor in Texas as a teenager had cured him of that ambition, and the Yukon had taught him that the real gold was mined at the faro tables and the bar. But Rawhide offered a golden opportunity, a narrow, dirt road canyon leading right up to Goodwin's claims. It was a tight, treacherous strip of land shaped like a stingaree fish. It was close enough to a respectable town to draw a crowd, but entirely outside the reach of its laws. As the Thomas Flyer lurched forward, leaving Goldfield and Johnny Mays in the dust, Tex slipped the postcard into his breast pocket. Stingaree Gulch was waiting. Thomas Flyer conquered the Nevada washboard with all the grace of a rolling boulder, its brass radiator hissing like an angry diamondback by the time they reached the canyon mouth. Blohm muscled the heavy steering wheel, fighting the deep ruts until the grade grew too steep. He threw the brake lever and killed the engine. The sudden silence of the desert rushed in, broken only by the ticking of the overheated motor and the relentless howl of the wind funneling through the rock walls. "This is it, boss?" Blohm asked, his thick German accent clipping the words. He climbed out, wiping a thick layer of alkali dust from his goggles. He looked up the canyon, his heavy jaw set in a scowl. "There is nothing here. Rocks. Sagebrush. Maybe a few rattlesnakes." Tex stepped out of the Flyer, his boots crunching against the hard pan. He didn't bother dusting off his tailored suit. He walked a few paces into the canyon, turning slowly, taking the measure of the high, shadowed walls. The defile was a geographic anomaly. It flared wide at the entrance where they stood, then narrowed sharply, winding upward in a long, whip-thin trail toward Hooligan's Hill. It was a perfect bottleneck. "You're looking at the dirt, Blohm," Tex said, a slow, wolfish grin spreading across his face. "You have to look at the geometry." "Geometry does not pour whiskey." "It does if you know how to build on it," Tex replied. He pointed a leather-gloved finger toward the wide, flat basin at the canyon's mouth. "Look at the shape of it, broad at the head, trailing off into a long, wicked tail, like a stingery. Right here, at the head? That's where we drop the New Northern, biggest bar in the territory. We put the gaming tables up front where the light hits the gold, and the dance halls flanking it on both sides." Tex walked further in, his mind already framing the lumber, laying the canvas, and lighting the kerosene lamps. "Up the tail," Tex continued, gesturing to the narrow, winding path that led up the grade. "That's the line. A solid mile of cribs and parlor houses. Every man who works up on Hooligan's Hill is going to have to walk right down the tail of the stingaree to get to town. And by the time they reach the head, their pockets will be completely empty." Blohm crossed his massive arms, looking up the hill toward where Nat Goodwin's doomed mining claim sat. "Goodwin is paying them well to dig out worthless rock." "Exactly," Tex said, pulling a silver flask from his coat. He took a short pull and tossed it to his enforcer. "Nat Goodwin is a fool, but he's a rich fool paying good wages. Those miners are going to be breaking their backs in the dark all day. When they come down that hill, they aren't going to want a quiet evening. They're going to want exactly what my postcard promised them." Tex reached down, picked up a jagged piece of quartz, and used it to carve a long, deep line across the dirt road, marking the threshold of his new domain. "Get back in the Flyer, Blohm. We ride into Rawhide, buy up every scrap of lumber and canvas they have, and hire every man who can swing a hammer. Stingaree Gulch opens by the end of the week." By sunset on Friday, the canyon smelled of fresh-cut pine, cheap rose water, and wet paint. By midnight, those scents had been entirely swallowed by the thick, intoxicating musk of cigar smoke, spilled whiskey, and the sweat of 1,000 desperate men. Standing on the raised landing of his newly minted northern saloon, Tex Rickard looked out over an empire of glorious, manufactured chaos. It was a masterpiece of temptation. He had promised a ring-tailed, roaring good time, and he was delivering it at a deafening volume. 24 different dance halls lined the wide head of the canyon, each boasting its own orchestra. Ragtime pianos clashed with weeping fiddles and blasting brass cornets, creating a magnificent, riotous wall of sound that echoed off the canyon walls. Out in the dirt street, miners shoved past each other, waving Texas-printed postcards like golden tickets. "Boss!" Blohm's voice boomed over the din. The giant German shoved his way up the stairs, a canvas bank sack gripped in each of his massive fists. He was sweating through his suit, but his eyes were wide with a rare, manic energy. "The cages are already running out of silver. They are paying in gold dust and company scrip." "Take the scrip, but discount it 10%, Tex shouted back, never taking his eyes off the floor. "And tell the dealers to speed up the hands. I want the cards moving." Tex stepped to the railing and looked past the saloon doors, up toward the narrow canyon pass, the tail of the Stingaree. It was glowing against the black Nevada sky. 600 red lanterns hung outside a mile of canvas tents and hastily built wooden cribs. The line was alive. Just as Tex had predicted, Nat Goodwin's overpaid miners had dropped their picks the second the whistle blew and marched straight down Hooligan's Hill. They came down the tail with heavy pockets, and by the time they reached the northern at the bottom, they were practically throwing their wages at the roulette tables, the faro dealers, and the bartenders pouring Kentucky bourbon. Down on the main floor, a scuffle broke out at a poker table. A dust-covered miner leaped to his feet, overturning a chair and grabbing the dealer by the lapels. Before Tex could even signal, Blohm was moving. The enforcer descended the stairs with frightening speed. He didn't draw a weapon. He didn't need to. Blohm simply grabbed the furious miner by the back of his collar and the seat of his canvas trousers, lifted him entirely off his feet, and hurled him through the swinging saloon doors into the dusty street. Blohm dusted his hands, turned to the stunned table, and pointed a thick finger at the cards. "Honest gaming," he barked. "Play." The dealer swallowed hard, straightened his tie, and began to shuffle. Tex smiled, pulling a cigar from his vest pocket and striking a match against the wooden railing. He had left Goldfield by the skin of his teeth, trading a fortune for his life. But as he listened to the clinking of glasses and the relentless scrape of chips across felt, he knew he hadn't just recovered his losses. Johnny Mays could have Goldfield. George Graham Rice could keep selling fake dirt to Nat Goodwin. Tex Rickard was mining the miners, and he had just struck the motherlode. Tex looked up the hill to where the massive arc lights were ensuring that construction continued 24 hours a day. During his very first week, Tex Rickard netted nearly $25,000 from the gulch. He knew as soon as the new road was complete, his take would double. And the town of Rawhide had just hired 300 Greek workers to finish the road as quickly as possible. He decided to triple his last order for the printed postcards. His hired agents passed them out everywhere. They met ships arriving in port, greeted trainmen as they completed their shifts, visited hundreds of mining towns and factories, and were welcome guests at many lodge meetings. Volume. Tex wanted to be ready for volume. Tex Rickard leaned back in his leather chair, the tip of his cigar glowing like a forge ember in the dim light of the back office. Spread across the scarred oak desk before him were blueprints for his new establishment, a palace of vice and velvet that would make the rough-hewn miners and newly rich cattlemen empty their pockets with a smile. He tapped a manicured finger against the architectural drawings. His instructions to his enforcer were simple, but the execution required finesse. "Get me girls, Blom," Tex said, his voice a low, gravelly drawl that commanded absolute attention. "Buy out as many working banyos as you can. Offer the madams top dollar to relocate. Whatever they're making now, tell them I'll double it. Promise them ornate facilities. We're talking brass fixtures, actual electric lights, and flush lavatories. No more outhouses in the freezing mud." He leaned forward, locking eyes with the giant German standing on the other side of the desk. "We'll give them first-rate protection and put them on a strict commission system. None of this back-alley robbery. Everything will be on the up-and-up. Treat it like a bank, and it'll pay like a mint." Blom, a mountain of a man whose tailored suits barely contained the thick slabs of muscle beneath, gave a slow, deliberate nod. "You need a certain kind of woman to run a place like that, boss, not the usual alley cats." "Exactly," Tex agreed, pointing the burning end of his cigar at Blom. "Find me good mamas, women who know how to balance a ledger and keep a house in line. She needs to run a clean place. I mean that literally, Blom. Make her girls take regular baths, rose water, and French soap." Tex stood, pacing the short length of the room. His vision was clear, cutting through the typical grime of boomtown enterprise. "I don't want any boozed-up women stumbling down my staircases, and absolutely no pipe smokers. No opium, no laudanum drunks. It brings the wrong kind of heat and ruins the illusion. We're going to run a top-shelf place, a gentleman's oasis. The men will gladly pay double for our kind of entertainment, provided we make them feel like kings." Blom knew exactly where to start. 3 days later, the rhythmic clatter of the eastbound train deposited the giant German into the soot-choked, bustling heart of St. Louis. He bypassed the cheap saloons and the waterfront dives, making his way to the city's more polished Tenderloin district. He was looking for a particular madam, a woman whose reputation for discretion and high earnings was legendary among the sporting crowd. He knew her well, because long before she draped herself in silk and southern mystique, they had run the same cold streets back in the old country. Like him, she was from Dresden. Her name had originally been Frida. Now, the brass plaque beside the heavy oak door of her establishment read, "Madame Cora Belmont." When Blom was ushered into her private parlor, the air was thick with the scent of jasmine and expensive wax. Cora sat at a vanity, dressed in a sweeping velvet gown. She was a striking woman, radiating a practiced, aristocratic charm. She claimed to be from New Orleans, and speaking flawless, accented French was just one of her many carefully honed skills. "Blom," she purred in a molasses-thick drawl, turning to appraise the giant. "To what do I owe the pleasure of this intrusion?" Blom closed the heavy parlor door, cutting off the tinny piano music drifting from the floor below. He dropped his coat onto a fainting couch and switched effortlessly to his native tongue. "Drop the Creole act, Frida," Blom rumbled in crisp, guttural German. "I am here on behalf of Tex Rickard, and I brought a very large checkbook. Pack your trunks. We are going to build a palace." Cora's eyes flashed with calculating interest. The Southern Belle vanished instantly, replaced by the sharp, pragmatic businesswoman from Dresden. "Tell me about the plumbing," she replied in perfect German, gesturing to a velvet chair. "And then tell me about the money." Thank you. Every morning at 8 o'clock, Cora Belmont told her personal maid that she was leaving now, and to please lock the door. Of course, she gave her instructions in perfect French because her maid spoke only French. Cora then descended the 3 floors of the grand staircase of the Hotel Avalon to the lobby, where the doorman opened the main doors to the dusty streets of Rawhide. She moved elegantly to where Blome was waiting with the horse and buggy. He dismounted the carriage and politely assisted her up. As he did so, she greeted him, speaking in German. "Guten Morgen, Herr Blom. Wie geht es dir?" She was teasing him by using the intimate, very familiar form of the language. However, he would never respond to the tease, always maintaining his strict formality. "Mir geht es heute Morgen gut. Es war ein profitabler Abend für Mr. Rickards Unternehmungen." No matter how the business had actually gone, Blom would always assert its profitability. Once they were both settled in the buggy, he clicked his tongue for the horse to get going. They headed immediately for the back entrance of Tex Rickards' giant Hercules Grand Saloon, where he had moved his headquarters operations. There, Blom secured the buggy and assisted Cora down to the wooden porch. He used his keys to open the always locked door. Together, they climbed the 3 flights of the back stairs to where they encountered another locked door. This one was made for maximum security with barred iron and 2 separate key locks. Inside, they bypassed the austere counting room and directly entered Tex's private sanctum. What had surprised Cora on her first visit was how much of the space was occupied by Tex's 3 gigantic, heavy-duty iron safes, anchoring the room like silent sentinels. They left little room for Tex's massive mahogany desk or the chairs. To a passing visitor, the sheer size and number of the vaults looked like utter paranoia. But in a booming, volatile town like Rawhide, paranoia was just another word for survival. Those 3 safes were born from the fire and blood of H.L. Gleason's infamous dynamite caper. The story of the safes began with a partnership forged in the dust of the Nevada boomtowns. Long before they arrived, Tex had allied himself with Al Brighton. Brighton, a shrewd man who had traveled down from Genoa just months prior, owned one of Rawhide's 3 banks. When Tex set his sights on developing Stingery Gulch, it was Brighton who helped to bankroll the dream, providing a massive chunk of the funding. In return, Tex anchored his trust, and his own considerable fortune, inside the vault of Brighton's bank. But wealth in a boomtown breeds bitter enemies. Enter H.L. Gleason. A business deal between Gleason and Brighton had recently gone horribly sour, leaving Gleason nursing a festering, venomous grudge. Gleason wasn't quiet about it either. He spewed threats against the banker to anyone who would listen. In a tough town, angry words were cheap, and most folks brushed Gleason off as a hothead blowing off steam. No one realized he was about to blow up the bank instead. It happened on a seemingly ordinary afternoon. Without warning, the sharp, violent crash of shattering glass echoed down the street. Gleason had hurled 4 live sticks of dynamite straight through the front window of Brighton's bank. Hearing the commotion, Al Brighton rushed from his desk toward the front to investigate. He never had a chance. The dynamite detonated with a deafening, earth-shaking roar that blew the front of the bank apart, tragically killing Brighton in the blast. The smoke hadn't even cleared before the shock of the explosion mutated into a lethal, roaring rage. A mob of Rawhide citizens materialized from the saloons and claims, ropes in hand, their eyes fixed on summary boomtown justice. They meant to drag Gleason into the street and string him up right there in the dust. It was only the desperate, iron-willed intervention of the local sheriff that kept the mob at bay. Standing between the vigilantes and their prey, the sheriff managed to secure Gleason and take him out of town to the sturdier jail up in Carson City. There, the law handled what the mob had started. Gleason was tried, convicted, and hung by the neck until dead. Back in Rawhide, the dust settled, but Tex Rickard was changed. Having lost his financial anchor and a close partner in one violent flash, he made a silent vow before the splintered remains of the bank. He pulled whatever wealth he had left, sent away for the three largest, heaviest iron vaults money could buy, and dragged them directly into his private office. From that day on, Tex Rickard never trusted a bank again. Now, they served as the iron heart of his empire. As Blom switched on the electric lights, providing the only illumination for the windowless room, Cora's attention returned to the present. She moved to the middle safe, the one with red roses painted on its heavy iron door. It bore a dial, a handle, and the words E. L. Burns and Sons, Gary, Indiana. When Blom was ready, she began twisting the dial to the necessary numbers, calling out each in German as she moved to them. 53, 16, 29, 7, 16, 53, 16, 29, 7, 16. After the last number clicked into place, she pulled the handle and swung the heavy door open. From it, she retrieved her meticulously recorded ledger book. Then she closed the safe, and she and Blom made their way back down the stairs to the buggy. The rest of the morning was spent strictly on business. They visited each parlor house in the gulch, spoke with the madams, quizzed the bouncers, collected the money, and rendered whatever discipline was necessary to maintain a quality operation. As they moved from place to place, Cora recorded every last detail in her leather-bound book. Back at the Hercules Grand Saloon, they entered once more, climbed the back stairs, and this time stopped in the austere counting room outside Tex's office. There, Cora methodically organized the morning's take into various piles, separating income and expenses for each house. Once finished, she returned to Tex's office and placed both her ledger book and the stacks of cash carefully inside the safe with the painted roses. Locking it shut with a heavy, satisfying metallic click, she knew all that remained of her morning's work was to return to her hotel room, where her French-speaking maid had already drawn her bath. The dust in Rawhide was as persistent as the swindlers, clinging to the wool suits of men who traded shares in holes that held no gold. Tex Rickard sat at a corner table in his newly finished Hercules Grand Saloon, ignoring the frantic din of the stock peddlers at the bar. Spread before him were three crumpled telegrams, all rejections. He needed to build a fight. Not just any fight, but a heavyweight championship bout for Jack Johnson. Jack was a friend, a titan in the ring, and currently the most hated man in America for having the audacity to be black, brilliant, and entirely unapologetic. Every potential backer Tex approached gave the same answer. It's too dangerous. Nobody will host him. The public will riot. Tex needed deep pockets and ironclad connections, and the men in Rawhide were offering neither. The heavy scent of rose water and expensive French powder cut through the stale cigar smoke before Tex even looked up. "They told me I might find you counting your troubles at the bottom of a glass, Mr. Rickard." Tex glanced up. Standing before him was a woman who decidedly did not belong in the Nevada dirt. She was dressed in the severe black silk of mourning, but the cut was immaculate, and the veil was pinned back to reveal sharp, assessing eyes and a perfectly composed smile. "It's prune juice, ma'am. Can't do whiskey anymore. Tex stood, removing his Stetson out of habit. But I'm afraid you have me at a disadvantage, ma'am. I don't believe we've met. We haven't, she said, taking the liberty of seating herself opposite him. She stripped off a black kid leather glove. But you knew my late husband, or at least, you knew his circle. I am Mrs. Vera Locke, widow of William Locke. Tex's brow furrowed for a fraction of a second before the name clicked. Big Bill Locke, the Cincinnati circuit. Raleigh Graham's associate, Tex said, his tone shifting from polite dismissal to cautious interest. Raleigh Graham was a legend in the sporting crowd, a man who would drop $175,000 on a single horse and sleep soundly that night. The very same, Vera sighed, her eyes dropping in a masterful display of practiced grief. Bill left me far too soon, but he also left me with a rather substantial estate and a network of gentlemen who prefer the quiet handling of loud affairs. Men like Bat Masterson, Wyatt Earp. She paused, letting the heavyweight names land. Men who understand the fight game. Tex slowly sat back down, leaving his glass untouched. I'm sorry for your loss, Mrs. Locke, but Rawhide is a rough place for a widow, especially one with a substantial estate. The wolves here will sell you a gold mine that's nothing but sand. I am not in the market for sand, Mr. Rickard, Vera said smoothly. Her eyes flicked down to the crumpled telegrams on the table. I am in the market for a spectacle. Raleigh always told Bill that a smart backer buys when the crowd is terrified. And from what I hear out of San Francisco and Chicago, all of America is terrified of Jack Johnson. Tex froze. He had been keeping his plans as quiet as possible, floating inquiries only to a select few. Word travels, Tex, she said, using his first name with a familiarity that felt strangely earned. You have the fighter. You have the vision. But you are hitting a wall because the men with the money are cowards. They care about polite society. And you don't? Vera offered a thin, conspiratorial smile. Polite society bored my husband to tears, and it bores me. I have capital sitting idle in Denver banks, and I have connections to mayors and governors who owe the Graham Locke Syndicate favors. I am looking for a partner who isn't afraid of a little heat. She leaned in closer, the veil casting a soft shadow over her face. You need a miracle to put Jack Johnson in that ring. I have the funds to build the arena and the leverage to keep the law out of your way. Buy me a cup of coffee, Mr. Rickard, and let's talk about making history. Tex looked at the woman. He knew the sporting crowd. He knew the grifters of Rawhide. But a widow holding the keys to the Graham Empire? She was the answer to a prayer he hadn't even finished praying. Mrs. Locke, Tex said, signaling the bartender. Coffee won't do. Let me buy you a steak.
The Hercules Grand Saloon's private dining room offered a thin illusion of quiet, the heavy velvet curtains muting the roar of the stock peddlers outside. Tex carved his steak, watching Vera Locke from across the table. She ate with the precise, unhurried grace of a woman used to fine dining, a stark contrast to the rough-hewn boomtown surrounding them. So, Tex said, setting his knife down, you want to back a fight that half the country wants banned, and you want to do it in a town like this? Vera dabbed her lips with a linen napkin. Not in Rawhide, heavens no. This town is a mirage, Mr. Rickard. It will blow away with the next strong wind. No, we stage it somewhere real. Reno, perhaps, or somewhere just outside San Francisco. But the location is secondary to the politics. Tex nodded slowly. The politics are the whole game. The moment I announce Jack Johnson is fighting a white heavyweight for the title, every moral crusader and reform politician from here to New York will try to shut it down. They'll call out the state militia if they have to.
Exactly,
Vera said, leaning in, her voice dropping to a conspiratorial murmur.
Which is why you need Raleigh Graham's architecture. Before my husband passed, he and Raleigh established a, let's call it a benevolence fund, in several state capitals. We have men who can ensure the governor's office remains perfectly oblivious to our spectacle until the bell rings. No militia, no injunctions.
Tex felt a surge of genuine excitement. This was the missing piece. He could build the arena, he could sell the tickets, but he couldn't fight the state government. And what does this benevolence cost?
A fraction of what the fight will gross, Vera replied dismissively. I am prepared to underwrite the entire purse. $100,000, guaranteed. I will also front the capital for a 30,000-seat arena.
Tex stared at her. $100,000 was an astronomical sum, enough to lure any white heavyweight champion out of hiding to fight Johnson.
That is a very generous offer, Mrs. Locke. What is the catch?
Vera offered a small, appreciative smile.
You are a smart man, Tex. The catch is the banking. The Locke estate is vast, but it is currently navigating the tedious waters of probate in Colorado.
My primary capital is tied up in trusts managed by exceedingly conservative bankers, men who would faint at the idea of funding a racially integrated prize fight. She reached into her reticule and produced a silver cigarette case, though she didn't open it, merely turning it over in her gloved hands. I can bypass the trust to fund the purse and the arena through a blind holding company, she explained smoothly. But I cannot move the cash required for the political lubrication without triggering an inquiry from the estate executors. They watch my direct withdrawals like hawks.
Tex saw the trap closing, though to him, it looked like a door opening.
So, you need me to front the bribe money.
I need you to secure the political landscape, Vera corrected gently. My fixer in Carson City requires $25,000 in cash, in a satchel, by Friday. He distributes it to the right senators, the sheriff, and the governor's inner circle. Once the fight is legally sanctioned and the state's blessing is ironclad, my holding company releases the $100,000 for the purse into our joint account.
She reached across the table, her gloved hand resting lightly over his.
You put up $25,000, Tex. In return, I finance the biggest fight in the history of the world, and we split the gate receipts 50-50. It is a leap of faith, I know. But men like Bat Masterson and my late husband didn't build their empires by waiting for permission.
Tex looked at her hand, then at the untouched juice beside his plate. $25,000 was nearly everything he had liquid. It was a massive risk, but the names she dropped, the cool confidence of her demeanor, and the desperate, burning desire to see Jack Johnson crowned champion clouded his usually sharp judgment. It wasn't just an investment, it was a crusade. And Vera Locke had just handed him the sword.
$25,000, Tex murmured, his mind already calculating which of his three safes held the necessary cash.
By Friday.
By Friday, Vera confirmed, her eyes soft, her trap perfectly, flawlessly sprung.
Right.
Rawhide, Nevada was a town built by stock manipulation, a showy display of success that didn't exist. It thrived only by manipulators selling worthless mining stocks to other manipulators. Henry Chenworth, 1931. Rawhide was a town choking on its own illusions, a haven for confidence operators looking to mine the miners. Most of these grifters were men with cheap suits and cheaper talk, but Mrs. Vera Locke stood alone at the summit. Her phenomenal success didn't come from the ghost of Big Bill Locke, nor did it rely on the deep pockets of the Cincinnati circuit. Her true syndicate was a network of underpaid accomplices working the telegraph wires. By bribing operators across the state, she had systematically intercepted Tex Rickard's desperate cables to potential backers. She knew his exact capital, his deepest fears, and his precise breaking point before she ever stepped foot in the Hercules Grand Saloon. Armed with his stolen secrets, the rest of the sting was just her pure, unadulterated talent for theater. Tex lost the money, but he didn't lose his ambition. Bruised but unbowed, he eventually willed his fight of the century into existence. On July 4, 1910, under a blistering sun, he achieved the impossible. Jack Johnson defended his title, and Tex walked away with a staggering, historic fortune. Historians estimate he pocketed a cool $5 million from the gate and the moving picture rights. He had built his spectacle. But he couldn't control the shockwave. When the referee raised Jack Johnson's glove, the bell didn't just end the bout. It lit a powder keg beneath a deeply fractured nation. Humiliated by the decisive victory of a black man over their great white hope, white America retaliated with horrific, unchecked violence. Race riots erupted like brush fires across 25 states and over 50 cities. In New York City, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, New Orleans, Atlanta, St. Louis, Little Rock, and Houston, white mobs spilled into the streets. They attacked black citizens with savage beatings, burned homes and prosperous businesses to the ground, and committed ruthless lynchings. The sporting triumph had birthed a national tragedy. In the shadows of the arena, a different kind of violence was brewing. The financial fallout of the fight was catastrophic for the underworld. In the ensuing chaos, the massive volume of losing bets on the white challenger were simply never paid off. Powerful bookies, violent gambling syndicates, and mob enforcers were left holding millions in absolutely worthless paper markers. They were bleeding money, and they were looking for someone to blame. Tex Rickard looked at the burning cities, the furious syndicates, and his own bursting bank accounts. With the heat of a fractured nation and the ire of the criminal underworld breathing down his neck, the harsh Nevada desert suddenly lost its appeal. Looking at a map of the world, Tex found it immensely, urgently convenient to quietly board a ship heading south. Leaving the ashes of the American spectacle behind him, he took his millions and disappeared into the quiet, untouchable expanses of Paraguay, deciding that a sprawling cattle ranch was a much safer bet than the fight game, at least for now.
We'll be right back.
Appaloosa Radio offers a new work in historical fiction, Stingaree Gulch, A Ring-Tailed Roaring Good Time.